On Election Day, we look back at elections past. Election season may seem more supercharged, more partisan, and more negative than ever before. But students of history will tell you it has always been this way. Mudslinging and dirty tricks are as old as the hills. One of the most famous examples of this, the 1884 presidential election between Maine Republican James G. Blaine and Democrat Grover Cleveland, which saw a paternity scandal, draft-dodging claims, bribery, and other misdeeds. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the show, we will spend an hour learning about more notable elections in Maine and U.S. history. We'll also discuss the role of independent candidates and the historical significance of ranked choice voting. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. It is a busy election day today, and we are taking the opportunity to delve into elections of the past, both here in Maine and across the nation. What elections have been nail-biters? Have some of the issues today, such as voter fraud and ranked choice voting, cropped up previously? Our guests will share some stories. And with me in our studio, Herb Adams, who's an adjunct professor at Southern Maine Community College and former longtime state representative from Portland. You are likely to find Herb in the archives of the Maine Historical Society on many days. And Jeffrey Selinger is an associate professor in the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you aware of any interesting facts about past elections? Do you see examples of history repeating itself when it comes to campaign controversies? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome both to you. Welcome back, Jeff and Herb. It's so nice to see you. It's been a while. I want to start by let's talk about a presidential election in the history that involved a candidate from Maine. And I'm not talking about Ed Muskie. I'm talking about James G. Blaine, the man whom the Blaine House, our governor's mansion, is named for. Herb Adams, when James Blaine ran for president in 1884, this was not a civil, lovely, peaceful time in American politics, was it?
Certainly was not. You think this is a mud pie election. You know, your great-great-grandparents would have pointed toward 1884, but Maine would have pointed to that too, because it was the first national election in which a Mainer was at the top of the ticket. That is, running for president of the United States. Now, James Blaine was actually not a native Mainer. He came from Pennsylvania. But he moved here to edit a paper. It still exists. We've all read it. The Kennebec Journal. And from there, because of his enormous acumen, his ability to charm people, and his ability to scheme, he eventually rose through the Maine legislature to be Speaker of the United States House of Representatives and a senator from Maine. And in 1884, at long last, he was the bridegroom and not a bridesmaid, as he'd been so many other times. It looked like, for sure, he was going to be elected president of the United States, because his opponent was a 350-pound, otherwise rather dull but determined person, Grover Cleveland, who is the governor of New York, addicted to eating large meals, and lots of work. He'd stay very late at the office, not a campaigner, whereas Blaine was everything. He campaigned, he crisscrossed the country, all of that. He was a magnetic speaker. He was referred to as the great magnetic candidate. There were jokes about it at the time, showing him attracting pins and metal things and loose votes. He was known not to be over-scrupulous, shall we say, and maybe a little too friendly with the railroads. Well, Blaine versus Cleveland looked to be a slam dunk for the Republicans at the time, but turns out that Blaine's addiction to railroad bonds, that is cash, basically, from the railroads that came to him in flocks, got exposed by a clerk in the railroad department that saved James Blaine's letters to the presidents of railroads asking for money, basically. So The Democrats in those days, mass communication meant newspapers and huge parades, had a stamping cheer. Blaine Blaine, James G. Blaine, continental liar from the state of Maine, burn this letter, burn this letter. Turned out that they did have some dirt on Dull Grover Cleveland, too. He had had an illegitimate child.
Mama, where's my pirate?
That's right. This big 350-pound bald guy with a big nose and a mustache had an illegitimate child. Mama, where's my pa? Gone to the White House, ha, 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 replied the Republicans. Mark Twain thought it was just the most delicious thing watching these two sides just wail at each other. And it made, of course, in the early days of huge circulation newspapers, great copy. Joseph Pulitzer, fellow for whom the Pulitzer Prizes are named, made sure that all of this got all good coverage in his newspapers and printed a lot of anti-Blaine cartoons, which people who could vote but couldn't read could understand. Blaine was infuriated by it all. And to make it all worse, just a few days before Election Day, Blaine went to a dinner in New York, and the minister who gave the invocation said, we are proud to be Republicans and not the party of rum, Romanism, and rebellion. Now, what the heck's that mean? But it meant that Democrats were all drunks, probably Confederates, and therefore traitors, and worse yet, cat. Now, Blaine didn't apparently hear this or didn't pay attention, but that got all across the country quickly. And in short order, it rained on Election Day like it is today. Blaine lost New York State by about 1,300 votes. That he lost the electoral votes of the state of New York, and he lost the presidency for that. The Republicans really could barely stand it because the Democrats had another slogan that they whipped out. Hurrah for Maria, that was the illegitimate mother. Hurrah for the kid. I voted for Cleveland, and I'm GD, glad I did. So even though mass communication, blessingly, didn't exist in the way we know it, it was just as mean, just as nasty, perhaps more so on a scale that today we can't imagine. On the other hand, we don't want to either because we're going through enough of it now.
Yeah, and you know, we talk about a scale we might not be able to imagine. I mean, you know, saying that the church is has a role in an election, there's a direct line to what we're doing today, isn't there, Jeff?
Well, there's more than one direct line. I mean, well, one thing that we want to keep in mind when we think about, most of us didn't wake up this morning telling ourselves we were going to be thinking about elections in the 19th century. But it bears a reminder, not just about the terms in which these combatants were disputing and the kind of incendiary language you're hearing, rum, Romanism, and rebellion. It's very important to attend to how the elections were conducted. Because at that time, this is the time before we had what we now call the Australian ballot, the ballot that is cast in secret and it's printed by the government. Before that, up until and through the 1880s, the United States, or the vast majority of those who cast their vote, used what was called the party ticket system, where voting was not done in secret and it was not done in public places necessarily. It could be done at a pub or at a church, and there was intimidation. Actually, intimidation was often quite rampant. And so when trying to sort out what constituted a voting irregularity, the question that judges used to use was whether or not intimidation was excessive. Not was there intimidation, but was it excessive? Was there so much intimidation that a quote-unquote man of ordinary courage would be afraid to vote? So for the first century of the America's existence, voting was cast in public. There was widespread intimidation, petty bribes, and handouts, shots of whiskey, bags of coal, that sort of thing were part of the landscape. And one of the leading arguments against women's suffrage, that the polling place was not a place for a woman. And this is the argument that you can find if you look at Professor Richard Bensel, who teaches at Cornell, has done wrote a wonderful book on the ballot box in the 19th century. He details all of this this information.
And Jeff's right. You know, in those days, the ballots were printed by parties, by the party. They would be colored, so you knew what party at least your person was voting on, and they were cast in large glass bowls that looked like fish bowls. And they were done in public, so, you know, if you were a working man and went in and cast the wrong color ballot, you might get fired the next day.
Or beaten.
Or bribed. Mm-hmm. And the wonderful book by Alexander Callow called The Tweed Ring, the various things that the great Tweed political machine in New York would do to guarantee you were voting, quote, right, unquote. Mm-hmm. Maine, in fact, was one of the first states in the 1890s, thanks to the Maine State Grange movement and the emerging labor movement, to require that ballots had to be one color, a neutral color, the same for all, and cast in containers where the ballot itself was not visible. Mm. So one little point for us.
We're talking about elections past. Have elections changed in your lifetime? Have your parents or grandparents told you any stories about what it was like for them? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Jeff, right now, as people cast their votes today in at least a couple Maine races, three Maine races, there are independent, non-enrolled candidates running. And you know, we'll find out tomorrow what kind of impact they had in the race. We have somebody who's not a member of a political party as a U.S. senator in Maine right now. Why do we have now two parties and then somebody who's not a Democrat or Republican usually running unenrolled? I mean, I know there are some people who are Libertarian or Green, but what we see as a pattern are two parties that are dominant and maybe some unenrolled or independent candidates. This didn't used to be the way it was, correct?
It does seem to be a main thing that independents seem to do well, especially, you know, in the last couple of decades. But nationally speaking, you know, the dominant pattern is the pattern of an electoral duopoly, where you have two major parties at any given time, and it's the same two parties that there are prohibitive restrictions and hurdles that limit the participation of minor or third parties. I mean, historically, as I mentioned earlier, when there was a party ticket system, the two major parties did not have the means to restrict the participation of minor parties in the way they do today. So it was expected that minor parties would play a regular role in elections, and often played a role either as if you had a printing press and you had some volunteers, you had a party. You didn't have to get on a ballot. There were no ballot access rules or restrictions because there was no state or publicly printed ballot to begin with. So for the first century of America's experiment with democracy, it was a really raucous affair where not only were polling places sometimes unsafe and morally unsavory spaces, but you had a kind of raucous and unpredictable electoral environment where if one of the two major parties did not appeal to all of its followers, then a subset, a faction of one of the two parties could just bolt and get a printing press, print out lots of tickets, and run on a third party line, or there's no line, but challenge as a third and contending force, and this became such a prevalent phenomenon that especially in the Midwest and the West that the Populist Party, the People's Party, was on a regular basis, seemingly taking the place in some districts as the second major party, and on occasion, just to add to the confusion, if there wasn't already enough, one thing that they used to do was what's called electoral fusion, where two parties, and this was after the Australian ballot was in place. Fusion is the cross endorsement of a party candidate. So Democrats and populists would fuse with one another. That is to say, they'd list the same names but on two different lines, so that when you went to the ballot box, you would see Democratic and populist candidates listed in two places and a Republican listed in another place. And that way, electoral feature, electoral fusion, which has been prohibited in 43 states now has, you know, used to be an important feature of the American electoral landscape. It's been long since gone because past generations of partisans have tried to minimize as much as possible minor party participation.
Happened in Maine, too, though, of course, you know, especially the 1870s, where there are a lot of raucous greenbackers and loud Democrats, and they were the minority parties that pushed back against the overwhelming majority party Republicans in Maine then. Right now, though, I think if you asked people, do you vote the party or do you vote the person, Mainers probably, at least for two generations, would have said, I choose the person. And the latest statistics do show that, interestingly. If you draw this out on a graph, it looks like two fairly steep lines and then one not so steep. Right now, as of the end of September, about 35% of all people registered to vote in Maine would choose to be so-called independent, unenrolled. Democrats are close, 33.1%, and the Republicans are trailing somewhat, but again, at an incline, 27.4%. And ever since 1982, which was the last time Democrats in Maine had a clear majority of voters, plurality of voters, that would be the case. It's an interesting sort of like, on paper, it makes a crooked rainbow with many angles in it.
Is that usual, Jeff, or is Maine unusual to have so many, to have more non-enrolled, unenrolled voters than enrolled in either a political party, major political party?
It's really hard to say because, I mean, the first thing they, you know, when you first, you know, open this subject up, at least or when I first opened it up in graduate school, you know, the instruction number one was that, you know, in that classic spread of that since the University of Michigan started to conduct surveys that asked Americans on a regular basis about their partisanship, it's been noted that those who are partisan leaners, that is, those who are independent leaners, that is to say, those who identify themselves as independents but lean in favor of the Democrats or lean in favor of the Republicans, that those voters tend to be more reliable Democrats and Republicans, respectively, than weakly identified Democrats and weakly identified Republicans. So that is a long way of saying that those who call themselves independents are not necessarily independents, and most political scientists wouldn't treat them as such, that those who lean one way or the other, actually, when the rubber hits the road, they often vote with their party, and they're pretty consistent about it.
We're talking about elections and history, looking back at how elections have evolved here in Maine and across the country, and also some maybe notable elections in history. We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Jane and Frank Bragg of Bangor, proud supporters of the voices of independent and in-depth journalism at Maine Public News.
We've got a big election.
I am committed.
We believe that this is going to be a movement.
I am passionate.
They're going to say we can't win.
I am asking you to stand with me.
Today, the votes are coming in. Who will win and what will it mean for the country? Find out with live election night results and analysis from around the U.S. Critical elections, essential coverage, NPR News.
Election night coverage starts tonight at 8 on both Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Television. Today is Election Day, and if you have any last-minute questions before stepping into the booth, our Your Vote 2018 election resource is still available online at mainepublic.org. You'll find analysis of important issues, in-depth interviews, and profiles of the candidates for governor, Senate, and our two congressional districts, our Maine Calling candidate programs, our debates for on-demand viewing or listening, all this and more at mainepublic.org/yourvote. and do plan to join both Maine Public Radio and television starting at 8 this evening as the returns from around the state and the country come in.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Election History. Joining me in our studio, Jeffrey Selinger, who's Associate Professor of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, and Herb Adams, Adjunct Professor at Southern Maine Community College. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Jeff, three of the races this time around here in Maine are going to be determined by ranked choice voting. Is Maine going down into the history books for this?
I think so. This is a pretty significant experiment, and it has the potential to serve as an once it's carried on, and the election goes, and people have some experience with it, and see that it's a very easy and intuitive idea that is fully compatible with the way we have been supplements, but is fully compatible with the way we've been conducting our elections. I think it will be very popular.
Herb, we've heard the slogan, "As Maine goes." I think that's "As Maine goes, so goes the nation." I always thought it meant one thing, and only learned recently that it had really more to do with the timing of elections.
Well, it did. And like many wonderful slogans, you know, it's fun to repeat and hard to explain because it's not true and never has been, even though we would really love perhaps to think that it was. Maine held two elections in election years up till 1960. Up until 1960, we voted for governor and the legislature in September. And then there was another election in November in which you voted for your federal candidates. That's a result of the agricultural calendar. But that meant, starting in about 1840, Maine was a useful tool to the big-timers nationally because you had some indication of what one state was going to do politically 2 months in advance of the rest of the country. Now, to be sure, those days are talking about Whigs, W-H-I-G-S. Political party doesn't exist anymore. Abraham Lincoln was a Whig most of his life. And Democrats, but not the Democrats we think of today. So just look at them as funny chess pieces. We're moving around for a moment. In 1840, the Whig candidate for president won in Maine. And it was, let me put this correctly, the candidate, the Whig party, elected the governor of Maine, Edward Kent, Fort Kent, named for him. And so all of a sudden, it was supposed to be, as Maine goes, so goes the nation. And people gripped that as a phrase for many, many years and ran it onward from there. Now, it was never true, although it was interesting. Maine was kind of in accordance with the national trend maybe two-thirds of the time, but not reliably. But it's a catchphrase. You got to love such phrases with your heart and not your head. It's like rooting for the Red Sox. Root with your heart, not your head. So as Maine goes, so goes the nation. Put us in the front of a series of things that made us feel important, and we like to believe it. Well, you know, Sarah Palin used that phrase to a great roar of applause up in Bangor in 2008 when she was campaigning in the state of Maine. So it's still out there. And after all, if Sarah Palin says it, it must be true.
We'll go to Henry, who's calling from Newmarket, New Hampshire. Hi, Henry. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello. Yes, I'm calling to see if you would talk about the 1948 presidential election between Truman and Dewey.
That's right. Very famous headline and newspaper photo. Jeffrey, this doesn't happen very often anymore, but it's possible that we may have the wrong result the next morning.
It's possible, but it would have to be a pretty systematic error that was kind of carried on by a wide variety of different kinds of professional pollsters using different their own models.
How was it that it was believed the next day that Dewey had defeated Truman?
Well, I think as a political scientist, like to return to the period just followed that election of the early to mid 1950s, when they finally did come to not perfect, but but establish a highly reliable statistical metrics for gauging public opinion and making predictions. The science of the scientific study of public opinion really took off in the 1950s, and prior to that, there was too much dependence on outlets like Reader's Digest and on polls that were where there was a lot of self-selection going on, where people mailed in votes and that sort of thing, and there's a lot of change to come. But I don't know how much relevance that really carries for us
today.
I mean, now the problem is sorting through so much so many different kinds of scientifically and professionally conducted survey research outfits and trying to weigh them and all else being equal, it's best to just rely on averages of them.
So that headline, the famous Dewey defeats Truman, was based on polls. It wasn't based on the actual results.
Probably. I have to refresh my memory on the on that specific episode, but I believe so that there was the journalists were relying too heavily on the hype and on Reader's Digest and other kinds of outlets like that, pretty embarrassing.
It was the early edition of the Chicago newspaper that Harry Truman's holding up in that famous picture. I had the real honor of knowing Harry Truman's speechwriter, Kenneth Heckler, who just died a few years ago, well over 100. And he told me that Truman loved that headline and kept that framed or a copy of that framed newspaper in his home in Independence, Missouri, on the wall to the end of his life. It might be a good springboard at this point to point out that... I beg your pardon.
That's fine.
Maine, starting with 1948, has an unusual tradition of its own that makes us perhaps smile a little bit, respecting close elections. Would you like to hear about that?
Sure.
Well, the five closest elections of the last half of the 20th century, these were the nail biters and the headbangers of their day. That would be 1948, the famous headline that Jeff's just spoken of, Dewey versus Truman, 1960, Nixon versus Kennedy, 1968, Humphrey versus Nixon, 1976, Ford v. Carter, and 2000, Bush v. Gore. Each of those, in their own way and day, Maine was regarded as maybe not a toss-up, but in today's parlance, a swing state. It depended on who you had going to the polls, whether it rained or not, like it is today, and many other factors that may have less to do with value judgments about the worthiness of a candidate. But nevertheless, you feed it all together. And in each of those elections, well, we know who won in each case. Harry Truman was elected in 1948, John Kennedy in 1960, 68, Richard Nixon, 1976, Jimmy Carter, and in 2000, after extended recount, George W. Bush. But in each and every one of those cases, Maine voted for the other side. We voted for the loser in every one of the five closest presidential elections of the last half of the 20th century. Not to say we didn't feel pretty good about what we did anyway, but there we are. There's no other state in the United States with that record, if that be a record.
That sounds like a great Trivial Pursuit question. Do people still play that? Henry, thank you so much. We'll move on to Steve, who's calling from Old Town. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks. So one of the topics of conversation was how politicians say they want to get along, and then one of my Republican friends said, has there ever been a dual governorship so that you elect a Democrat and a Republican? I don't know how you could work in the independent. But in other words, there was a dual governorship. I don't remember ever that in Maine, but maybe in the United States. And maybe its time has come. I don't know. It was a very hot topic after the conversation was brought up. So.
I can't say that I've ever heard of such a thing. There have been disputed elections where there is, in the 1840s in Rhode Island, about whether... who the duly elected governor of Rhode Island. There was a rebellion or insurrection that took place in Rhode Island, and which had to be settled by Congress. So there have been disputes in American history, contested elections for governorship, but never, to my knowledge, a dual governorship. But it brings us back to, you know, this is something that we all long for, and a lot of us, party polarization can be, deeply unsettling, and has been unsettling for Americans for many generations. And this younger generation may be the one that masters it. And the reason for my just very my preliminary optimism is this idea of ranked choice voting actually opens up new opportunities that I don't know if everyone fully appreciates. That when you have ranked choice voting, you no longer need to vote to avoid your least preferred outcome. And it actually creates incentives for, if the two parties are polarized, it creates incentives for centrists or moderates to get in the race and to adopt more positions that are located in the center of the ideological spectrum. And they could do well in general elections and without fear of wasting votes in this or that. But, to circle back to, what we were talking about earlier with Herb, as Maine goes, so does the rest of the country. I wouldn't be so terribly surprised if 30 years from now we look back and we look at Maine in 2018 and all the experience that Maine voters have built up during this very important day today in using ranked choice voting. And we look back and we see that, wow, this idea, this way of conducting an election is really simple and intuitive, and that others around the country are going to want to do it once Maine has demonstrated its efficacy.
We've never had a dual governorship in Maine. We have had the unusual circumstance of having four actual governors of Maine, real governors, in one 11-and-a-half-month period. And that caused enough turmoil then that today it would probably be more difficult. But it wasn't for bad reasons then. Edmund Muskie, who was governor of Maine, elected in 1958, had to resign early to go to the United States Senate. So in early 1959, January 2nd, he resigned in order to take his seat early in the and get a little extra seniority in the United States Senate. That meant that a Democrat, Edmund Muskie, departs, and the Senate President, Robert Haskell, the head of Bangor Hydro, who was Senate President at the time, was sworn in for 5 days to bridge the gap between Edmund Muskie and his successor, who had been elected that fall, who was a Democrat, Clinton Clausen, who was a chiropractor from Waterville. And he was sworn in for a 4-year term. And he died after 11 months in office. So a man who is president of the Maine State Senate again, John Reed, a Republican from Fort Fairfield, a potato farmer, became governor of Maine. So within 1 11-and-a-half-month period, we had 2 Democrats and 2 Republicans as governor of Maine. And their portraits all hang together in the State House today. Governor Haskell was very proud of being the 5-day governor, and his portrait is larger than many other people who are in 4 years, all hanging in the State House.
I have an email from Christopher. I was wondering if Herb could talk a little bit about the 1896 presidential ticket on which Arthur Sewell, my great-great-grandfather from Bath, was the running mate of William Jennings Bryan. They lost to McKinley and Hobart. The issue of the day was the silver standard.
Oh, very true, very true. I hope the caller will give you some information so I can contact him later. That is true. It goes back to what Jeff was talking about fusion earlier. The great commoner, William Jennings Bryan, one of the most eloquent men that ever ran for president, 3 times, in fact, stampeded the 1896 Democratic convention, 34 years old, just old enough, 35, 36, just old enough to be president. But he was also nominated by the populists. So he ran with one vice president on the populist ticket, and on the Democratic ticket, a shipbuilder from Bath, Arthur Sewell, was the nominee. for vice president of the United States. Unique in two ways. Number one, he's a Democrat in Maine. There were probably a grand total of six of them at the time. And number two, that he was a free silver person. The big issue of the day was, do you have a dollar in the Treasury in gold for every dollar in circulation that's paper, or do you have silver? Now, you could have 16 pieces of silver for every one gold dollar. And it was an argument about whether currency would be inflated or not. And Sewell came out in favor of inflation, basically. It was a fascinating race. He met William Jennings Bryan only once. They were not big friends. They didn't become big friends. Bryan came to Maine, did campaign very vigorously. Arthur Sewell joined him for that one day, and they never saw each other again. There's an interesting sub-story to it that the future governor of Maine, Percival Baxter, led a bunch of Bowdoin students to protest the appearance of William Jennings Bryan and got arrested for it, a thing that he was ashamed of all the rest of his life,
because
his father had to bail him out. But so Arthur Sewell, along with Ed Muskie, of course, who ran for vice president of the United States in 1968, and Hannibal Hamlin, the Republican, who ran with Lincoln in 1860, are Maine's vice presidential candidates. Actually, there are two more. Pat LaMarche ran for vice president on the Green Party ticket nationally in 2004. And Nelson Rockefeller, who was born in Maine, people forget that, up at Seal Harbor, served as vice president and appointed vice president for Ford. So as far as ringing the number two bell, Maine doesn't do too bad.
Thanks for your email, Christopher. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does MEMIC, with a mission of sending millions of dollars back to the Maine economy as part of their plan to make safety pay. Learn more at MEMIC.com.
It's the most impactful Maine election in years. Voters will choose a U.S. Senator, two members of Congress, a brand new governor, and the entire legislature. More info at mainepublic.org/yourvote. For election results, tune to Maine Public Radio or television beginning at 8 Tuesday night. The latest vote counts will be at mainepublic.org. I'm Erwin Gratz, and I'll have a complete roundup on Wednesday's morning edition on Maine Public Radio. Remember to vote, then join Maine Public for the results.
And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for ideas from the CBC. Today, David Weil, author of The Fissured Workplace, How Work Became So Bad for So Many, and What Can Be Done to Improve It. That's ideas from the CBC coming up after Maine Calling at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the history of elections here in Maine and across the country. My guest, Herb Adams with Southern Maine Community College and Jeffrey Selinger at Bowdoin College. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Freiburg and Dan. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. Looks like we lost Dan. If you could call us back, that'd be terrific. We'll go to Rena calling from Hollowell. Hi, Rena. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much. This is one of the best programs you've had. And I just want to point out that words matter. And we call them independents, but they're not. They're unenrolled or nothings. And we need to use this because people are proud of being independent. And we need to get people involved. So thank you, thank you.
Okay, Rena, thanks for your call. I want to ask you, do you mean that you don't believe people should be independent, should be unenrolled? Do you think it's sort of our civic duty to join a party and try to change it from within?
No, but I think they ought to be made to realize they're not independent, they're unenrolled.
Okay, gotcha. And that's a point that you were making, Jeffrey, before. I think there's two points. One, there is such a thing as the independent party, which is a very obscure party, right? And that when people say independent, what they really mean is unenrolled. But then also that what you were saying earlier, even if people think of themselves as independent, if you really look hard at yourself, you probably do lean one way or the other.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it depends on how we're going to address the question. If we're just talking about We're just trying to describe the phenomenon social scientifically. There are probably two different kinds of independents. There are those that that genuinely do vote for one party or the other, or vote for the independence party or independent party. I'm not actually sure exactly why it's called. And there are those who are partisan leaners, but they call themselves independent. That would be, if we were just approaching the issue descriptively, from a normative standpoint, however, which is where we really, that is from the point of view of our own sense of ethics and morality, we all like to view ourselves as independent individuals, as unencumbered by the expectations and demands of some other group that we've been ascribed to, or some political party, or whatever it may be. So it's certainly the case that we all fancy ourselves to be independent, and to a good extent, we often are. But I think the area where we get confused is when we're actually, get down to the nitty gritty of, okay, how do those people who call themselves independents, how do they actually vote? And where do they actually stand on the issues? And should we be calling them independents, or should we be calling them partisan leaders?
Herb, I want to ask you, you've referred a few times to how Maine used to be very staunchly Republican, in fact, overwhelmingly Republican. When did that change and why?
Interestingly enough, it's within the memory of people today. In 1954, Edmund Muskie then had been a state legislator and a lieutenant in the Navy during the war, Second World War, and was the too enthusiastic candidate for governor of the state of Maine on the Democratic Party ticket. Edmund Muskie really wanted to run for Congress, but he accepted the fact that, he drew the short straw and he would run for governor. Many things converged at that time. The first Maine television stations went on the air, and he had the right personality for it. Those of us privileged to know him near the end of his life saw some flashes of that old personality, very engaging, friendly, almost ungainly way in walking and all of that, and talking to you very sincerely, would look at you right in the eye. And all of a sudden, for a few $100s, which is about all they had, the Maine Democratic Party could put him on television. And people saw that Democrats didn't have horns and a tail. In fact, that looked like the guy down the street. In fact, he had been the guy down the street. His father, Stephen Marszewski, had been a Polish immigrant. Name was changed to Muskie. And he ran against a Republican who was not very popular even in his own party, Burton Cross, meaning nothing against him. He was known in his own party as Uncertain Burton and Double Cross. And he didn't come across well to people. Then there was Hurricane Edna, it so happened. Edmund Muskie was everywhere showing sympathy. Governor Cross was nowhere and sounding grumpy about how people better pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. And so in that September election that we were talking about earlier, Edmund Muskie ends up elected governor of Maine, an absolute earthquake in the political season. He was flown to New York City to appear on the Today Show with David Garraway. He was a national figure all of a sudden, a tailor's son from Rumford. And it was the beginning of a two-party system in Maine, which, if anything, has gotten more robust since in terms of real competition, engaging candidates, and a chance for everyone to participate in the system and be heard and feel they're being appreciated. One person really did sort of be the spearhead on changing all of that. It was a privilege to know him near the end of his life when the fires were banked, but they were still burning, let me tell you.
Moving on, I want to thank Rena for her question and move on to Lucille, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Lucille. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to tell you that I worked as a night dispatch for Bangor Hydro, switchboard dispatch, and the first week I was there, I found out that Bob Haskell had been governor. So I walked back into his office one night when it was slow and there was nobody around. I just had to sit in his governor's chair. He had his governor's chair and an easel in his office with his photograph, and I think they went to the Ed Muskie Museum. I'm not 100% sure. But I just had to sit in the governor's chair.
Well, Liz,
I just thought I'd add a little levity to today's conversation.
Thank you so much for sharing. That's a terrific story. I really appreciate you calling in. We'll go to Fred Hill, who's calling from Baltimore. Hi, Fred. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to make a point about the 1896 election, which reflects the transformation of the country in little more than a century. And I mentioned it in a book I did. In 1896, Maine had 6 electoral votes, second most in New England. Massachusetts had 15. I think Connecticut had 6, and Maine had 6. California had only 8. And I just wanted to pass that on because it shows how much the country's changed in little more than 100 years.
All right, Fred. And I understand you were a guest on Maine Calling before. Your book is Ships, Swindlers, and Scallywags?
Scalded Hogs.
Scalded Hogs.
I've read your book, and I enjoyed
it. Thank you. But I think it's a fascinating point about the fact that Maine had almost as many electoral votes a little more than 100 years ago than California.
Yeah. I've read your book, and I enjoyed it. And if you spend enough time in the legislature, you feel like a scalded hog, I'll tell you that.
But thank
since
thank
we're mentioning, we mentioned electoral votes. Maine has, in one other way, attempted to show the way to the United States, which, referring back to as Maine goes, so goes the nation. For many years, Maine was the only state in the modern United States that would split its electoral votes. Almost every other state, it's winner take all. Whoever gets the most votes in the presidential election in that state gets all of the electoral votes of that state. Hence, people who run for president spend a lot of time in California, New York, Pennsylvania, Florida, Texas, places like that where there's plenty of votes to be had. But it drew a little bit of attention to Maine because in 1972, we passed a law saying we would split our electoral vote. Whoever carried one of our two president, our two congressional districts would get that vote. And whoever got the most votes overall statewide would get the others. So it was possible for Maine to split 1-3, or somebody got all 4. As it happened, that never was used for years until this last time around.
2016, that's
and
right.
And it was split. Mr. Trump carried the second district. Democratic candidate carried Hillary Clinton, carried the rest of the state, and got 3. The only state that thought that necessarily that might level out the electoral landscape was Nebraska. And in 1996, they passed the same law. Now, they have 5 electoral votes. We have 4. And by golly, it took from then until 2008, and Mr. Obama took 1 of Nebraska's 5 electoral votes because he had a large concentration of campaign headquarters in the smallest electoral division in Nebraska, where the University of Nebraska and a lot of schools are. So there we go. I mean, Nebraska did it at last in 2008. Maine waited until 2016 to do it. So as Maine goes, so goes Nebraska.
Fred, thanks for your call. We'll move to Smithfield and Carrie. Hi, Carrie. Go ahead.
Hi. First of all, thank you very much for your excellent election coverage. And I'm calling to share my strategy as an independent voter because I truly am committed to real change, change that addresses, I think, the largest overarching issue globally, which is climate. And so I register as an independent, but being in a closed caucus state or previously when I lived in New York, a closed primary state, what I do is I switch over at the deadline prior to the caucus so that I can partake as one of the major two-party members and then immediately thereafter switch over to declare my true allegiance to an independent. So that's kind of my shifty little strategy.
Carrie, have you done it both directions? Have you joined the Republican Party and joined the Democratic Party before a caucus?
No, I have not.
All
but
right.
That doesn't affect how I vote. You know, I've heard those comments that an independent tends to have a leaning toward either side, and I tend to be exclusively issues-oriented rather than candidate-oriented, and not having a television really helps forego that ego identification with identity politics.
All right. Well, thanks for calling in. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call before we go. Heidi. Heidi, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Southern Maine, and I want to say how grateful I am for your coverage, too, and how blessed we are to have such an internationally renowned historian, eloquent historian as Herb Adams. And my concern is that, or my, I'd like to follow up on the theme going, the nation, the Maine to Nation theme, and that is that we are so blessed, according to Lawrence Lessig, the Harvard professor and former presidential candidate who I did a Facebook live stream with, he was saying how blessed we are as a state to have ranked choice voting. We have the Citizens Initiative and the clean elections going for us, and no other state in the nation, I think that's what he said, has that. And I think he's really pushing to get a nationwide effort going on this so that what we have in Maine can be rolled out throughout the country so that we have people voting their hearts and minds. And I'm voting for a free, for a clean future for our planet.
All right. Well, Heidi, thanks so much for calling in. Jeff, are we going to lead the nation? I know you've talked about ranked choice voting, but is there momentum toward clean elections and other citizens' initiatives of that sort in other states?
Well, I mean, staying with ranked choice voting just for a second, there's something to be said for a demonstration effect that here's a new system, a new way of doing things, a new way of conducting elections, of registering our preferences. And it's being put into effect today in one state. And an awful lot of people today are going to have a direct experience with it, and then they're going to reflect upon that. And my guess is they're going to realize that it was actually an awful lot easier than they had realized. And they might even wonder why it's taken us so long to come around to this way of doing things, that it's just much easier to register your preference and to and it's lower stress. You don't have to worry about wasting your vote or trying to vote negatively to prevent the least preferred candidate. So I wouldn't be surprised if this way of conducting elections, if it spreads, once it's been shown that it certainly can be done.
Well, Heidi, thanks for your call, and thank you to my guest today, Jeffrey Selinger, whose voice you just heard, associate professor in the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. Also here, Herb Adams, adjunct professor with Southern Maine Community College, longtime state representative from Portland. John Keimel ran the board today. Maine Calling will not be rebroadcast tonight, as it usually is, because of Maine Public's special election coverage. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, reaction and analysis to what is decided today. If you need any last-minute information, you can go to Your Vote, candidate interviews, and more at Maine Public's website. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.